Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Employment Matters podcast, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the world. I'm your host, Cato Arts, partner at Lydian in Belgium. On the program, we span the globe and receive updates on critical issues from ELA members in each region. On today's episode, we'll be discussing the new EU Artificial Intelligence Act. Joining us on the program are David van Boven, EU lawyer at Plessner, and Michael Hopp, partner at Plessner, both in Denmark. David and Michael, welcome. We are delighted to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you very much.
I'm very good as well. Thank you. And how are you?
Very good. Thank you. Happy to host you on this podcast. Let's dive right into it. So, Michael, what are some relevant use cases of HR, artificial intelligence, and what is the relevant legal landscape for the use of artificial intelligence by HR departments in the EU?
I think what we're seeing recently is that HR departments have turned into using artificial intelligence or AI, first of all, for recruitment purposes, to do, for example, CV scanning, to have an automated assessment of candidates, even without having the human understanding of what's going on. I mean, AI tools can assist with that. Obviously, we also see a lot of use cases involving evaluation, including performance evaluation, where AI tools can be used to analyze large amounts of data.
Okay. Why do you say the GDPR is so important for using artificial intelligence in HR?
When looking at this question, I think we need to take one step back and acknowledge that most use of data in the HR department will involve the use of personal data because it is about employees. And obviously, under the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU, we have a very broad definition of the concept of personal data. So whether you like it or not, a lot of what you will do with AI will involve the processing of personal data. In addition, I mean, to the broad concept of personal data, we also have a very broad concept of processing. And we even have a Court of Justice of the EU, which takes an expansive view on protection of individuals' fundamental rights, which the GDPR, at the end of the day, is an expression of, just like the new EU AI Act, which is also about protecting the fundamental rights of individuals. So at the end of the day, the General Data Protection Regulation will come into play a lot of time. Also think that it's worth keeping Article 1 of the GDPR in mind, which I think is very important for the overall understanding of European data protection law, because there it says that the GDPR is about protecting the fundamental rights and freedom of individuals, including the right of data protection. And normally when I teach data protection law, I always put it that way, that the GDPR is not about protecting personal data. It's about protecting individuals against the impact of the use of personal data. It's not about protecting the data. That might be the tool to protect individuals, but in theory, we're not really interested in the data. We're interested in the impact of the use of the data on the individuals. And if you take that approach, you can make a parallel in the AI context and say, well, it's not about regulating the use of AI. It's about regulating the impact of the use of AI on individuals' rights and freedoms. And of course, we do that by regulating the use of AI, just like we regulate the use of personal data. But the purpose is not to regulate the data as such.
That's a very interesting way to look at it. And I agree, that makes it much more tangible than just talking about the data or artificial intelligence. So thank you for that. David, what is the scope of the Artificial Intelligence Act?
Yeah, thank you, Cato. Yeah, so Michael already mentioned the AI Act, and the scope of the AI Act, actually, it's very important to know what the definition is of an AI system, because the AI Act applies to AI systems. And if we look at the definition in the AI Act, it says that it's about machine-based systems designed to operate with varying levels of autonomy that may exhibit adaptiveness after deployment, and that explicit or implicit objectives infers from the input it receives how to generate outputs such as predictions, content, recommendations, or decisions that can influence physical or virtual environments. So I'm obviously reading out loud this definition, but it's very important to unpack that a little bit and to also look at the recitals where it becomes clear that the AI Act, it's not about simple rule-based software or programming. That's really what the European Commission tried to exclude from the AI Act. Yeah, it's more than basic data processing, and it's about self-learning capability, and it's about inferring from an input to output. So yeah, that's very important to know. Then there's also this other notion of general purpose AI. There you have to think about chatbots. That's sort of a specific category, a specific box under the AI Act. And that can may come actually into play, especially for HR. What if you're using ChatGPT for evaluation, for example? It will be in scope of the AI Act. There are also important exemptions. Generally, yeah, AI used for researching, scientific research is out of scope. Important to know. There's also an exemption for open source AI, although there are some caveats to that exemption. Just to keep it simple, I'll just refer to that exemption in general. And lastly, I wanted to say that there's main distinction between providers and deployers. Providers are, you can consider them as the developers of AI, and the deployers are the business users. So not necessarily the end users, but the business users, such as an organization, the HR department using an HR AI tool. And then the approach of the AI Act actually is looking at these AI systems and categorizing in based on risk. There's certain prohibited AI use cases. You cannot use them for these use cases at all within the EU. And there's high risk AI use cases. We'll get to that in a little bit, but that's very relevant for HR. And then there's the more limited risk. It is actually general purpose AI is considered a more limited risk. And then you have the certain risk related to transparency. If you're using, for example, a chatbot, which is not necessarily general purpose, but you're using a chatbot, the end user must know that it's actually talking to a machine and not to a human. So there's some transparency requirements there.
Okay, thank you. That's a very clear overview, and it seems like a broadly large scope of application of the AI Act. What are these high-risk use cases that David just mentioned, Michael? Could you explain more about that?
Yeah. Annex 3 of the AI Act contains a fairly long list of what we would call high-risk use cases. But to be specific, in the HR context, we have two overall situations. We have the recruitment situation, which is phrased in the annex, where they talk about placing targeted job advertisements. So that would be some kind of, well, not targeted marketing, because you're not trying to sell something, but you are trying to promote your job advertisements towards targeted individuals. You also have the situation where you analyze and filter job applications. So that would be like the first rough reading of the applications. There you could have a robot do that job. And finally, evaluation. So as we know today, where at least here at Plessner, we would test candidates, both in terms of a cognitive test and a personality test. And there, if you use AI technology, as defined and as David just explained, that would be deemed high-risk use case. Then when people are hired, you have the second high-risk use case, of course, and that's where you use AI technology to make decisions about your staff, for example, promotions, terminations, task allocation, monitoring and evaluation of performance and behavior in the HR context. So roughly speaking, a lot of the things you would be doing in, well, maybe not the HR department as such, but also, so to speak, locally in the teams, a lot of what you could use AI for there would be deemed high risk.
And I get that these situations are determined high risk according to the AI Act, but I was wondering whether all these high risk systems are always high risk in practice as well.
Yeah, there, I would say, fortunately, during the final negotiations of the AI Act, an exception was introduced where deployer, in practice the employer, but we use the phrase deployer in the AI context, the deployer can make an assessment of the use of the AI system, and that it can even be done, depending on how specific the system is, can even be done by the system provider. You can make an assessment of the use case. And if you meet certain requirements for the use of a high-risk AI system, nonetheless, not be deemed high-risk if you meet those criteria. And amongst those criteria, I can just mention the situation that if you're only using an AI system to use what they call narrow procedural tasks, so that would be like labeling emails and stuff like that, I can't think of a practical example in the HR context, but no doubt once we see the guidelines, someone will come up with examples. But another possibility would be to say that if you're only using a high-risk AI system to improve the results of a previously completed human activity, that would be, for example, evaluating manual decisions about recruitment. So there you take your historical data about recruitment and you enter that into your AI system to get an analysis of how did they perform, who performed well, who performed less well. But you're not using the tool to make decisions. I mean, maybe some of the employees have already been terminated. Maybe they have all left. But you want to understand, why was it that someone stayed with us for 3 months and got terminated? Why was it that someone stayed with us for 2 years and left themselves? Or why was it that someone stayed with us for 10 years? I mean, submitting all kinds of historical data and getting analysis out. I mean, obviously, that is not decision-making because people have already left. That is learning about your manual or human decisions. So that's a few examples of situations where high-risk AI can nonetheless become low-risk.
It's very interesting. Thank you, Michael. Now, David, can you perhaps describe the main obligations under the AI Act and the specific roles?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so as mentioned before, there are these several roles under the AI, and the most important ones are the provider and the deployer. And depending on your role, so if you're, for example, developing the AI, you're the provider, then you have heavy obligations. But if you're the deployer, the business user, you have completely different obligations and generally lighter. And to give you some examples of the deployer's obligations, because we think that's most relevant for HR departments, as they are mostly just procuring off-the-shelf AI. Here we'll follow some examples. And also good to note, this is only related to the high-risk AI systems. So some of these obligations are to use the system in accordance of the instructions of the provider, of the developer. They will give you the instructions how to use it. The data you input to the AI system, you have to make sure the data is relevant and sufficiently representative. In the recitals, there's more description of what's meant by relevant and sufficiently representative, because you can imagine that's quite an open term, but may refer to geographically representative. For example, include if the AI is trained on a completely different language, consider, okay, what kind of input data am I going to use? Also have to ensure that there's human oversight and that human oversight is actually trained well. This is actually a general obligation also for non-high-risk AI. If you're using AI systems as defined under the AI Act, you have to ensure that the people using it are what's called AI literate, so they get basic training. Then there are some transparency requirements. You have to, for example, notify the employee representatives and affected employees that they will be subject to AI systems. So if you're using AI evaluation software, you have to inform the employees. And especially if it's about decision-making AI, actually more specifically, a high-risk AI system is what I was talking about. You have to really inform them up front. You can imagine that's a different kind of risk if it's really decision-making AI. Yeah, and you have to monitor the logs for an appropriate time, but that's at least 6 months. You have to retain those logs. And lastly, in the public sector, you have to perform fundamental rights impact assessments also for using these kind of AI systems. And that's similar to the data protection impact assessment that people know from the GDPR. These are some of the obligations under the AI Act for deployers.
Thank you, David. That looks like quite a lot for companies to take into account when they are dealing with AI. Michael, perhaps one final question. What are the key things or the key takeaways that you would like to tell to HR departments that are relevant in relation to the AI Act?
First key thing to mention is that apart from what we would call the blacklist, the prohibited use cases, which is not really relevant for an HR department, and they would never do that anyway, because HR departments are, generally speaking, boring. And here I mean boring in a very positive sense. What they should keep in mind is that in a couple of years, the requirements for high-risk use cases will apply. And obviously, you need to make an assessment of whether you can rely on one of the exceptions. In addition to that, I think the most important thing is to understand how are you using personal data today for various use cases, which would be, for example, automated decision-making. We have a special provision on that in the GDPR, Article 22. And even if you have automated decisions, which do not meet the requirement on Article 22, it's still processing. it still has a significant impact on individuals in many member states. Any use of AI will trigger the requirement for a data protection impact assessment, which means that you need to do a very thorough description of processing of personal data. You need to make an assessment of the lawfulness, and that's not risk-based, at least not under the GDPR. And then after that, you do a risk assessment in terms of the risk of having an unintended processing in violation of your gap analysis. We see varying degrees of compliance with the GDPR requirements on risk assessment. We see quite a lot of off-the-shelf use of standard solutions. We see a lot of management involvement. You could also call it management pressure, because that is what it is. I mean, nobody wants to be left behind there, but everybody wants to be able to say to the media that, well, we're ahead of the pack, or we're at least on par. We're using AI for these users. Be careful about what you're using AI for. I mean, very often the data protection regulators will have a fairly strict view on that. They do consider it high risk on a general level. And at least in Denmark, we already see cases or negative cases regarding the use of AI. So focus on the GDPR for now and focus on the privacy use cases under the AI Act.
Very interesting. Thank you so much, both of you. That's all the time we have today. David and Michael, this has been a very interesting discussion and a good takeaway for all employers who would like to look into the use of AI. Thank you for your time. It was a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you'd like to connect with David or Michael, please click on their bios in the description of this podcast. We also encourage you to reach out to any of our lawyers around the world by selecting Find a Lawyer on the ELA website at ela.law. In addition, search the ELA website where you can sign up to receive invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers and on-demand content from our online library, or access the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. Lastly, please download the brand new Employment Law Alliance mobile app and have the power of the ELA in the palm of your hand. You'll find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Gato Arts. Thanks for listening.